Welcome to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Your host, Carl Nordgren, will teach you how to take an expansive view on what it means to be creative and entrepreneurial. Carl is an entrepreneur, novelist, and a lifelong student. For 20 years, he has been learning how to help folks grow their creative capacities. Now, here's Carl.
Good morning and welcome. Thanks for joining us at 97.9 The Hill for another episode of Exploring Your Creative Genius. I'm Carl Nordgren. We take an expansive view, as the introduction says, of what it means to be creative. Why? So that you can construct your own understanding. The appreciation, the understanding, the realization of how you are creative, right? You're creative differently than I am. You have different creative needs than I have. And today I'm going to try to attack this topic. We go at it from lots of different directions, right? I want to give you lots of perspectives. Today we're going to go after the topic with a perspective I've never shared with you all before. And that is, I'm going to tell you some, I hope you'll find them to be fun and interesting stories about critters, about animals. I grew up with Ernest Thompson Seton's book on my bookshelf from the time I was six or seven till into my teenage years. I read it. The book was called Wild Animals I Have Known. So let's call this episode The Farmyard Animals That I Have Loved. And I'm going to talk about the roughly 20 years that my family and I lived on a six-acre farm. Farmette is really what I call it. I can't quite call it a farm. I've seen farms. I've worked on farms. This wasn't quite a farm. 6 acres, though, in South Durham County, down 751 south, right before you get to Stagecoach. That's where our little 6 acres was. And if you know that place, you know that our 6 acres bordered on 40,000 acres of woods, of forest, federally owned and managed by the Army Corps of Engineers for flood control and managed by the state for state wildlife. I recently found a journal, folks, where I inventoried the life that lived on this six-acre piece of property in June of 1994. That would be roughly 4 years after we moved onto this piece of property. Here's the list. Here's the inventory of animals that lived there. You're going to hear stories about some of them. 2 horses that we boarded and a Shetland pony named Joey. In this particular year, 1994, we had 2 goats, 2 Nubian does. In my notes in the journal, I say about 25 hens, and they were so radically free range, I could not have given you an exact number. They were more wild than not by this point in time. They had crossbred for a couple of generations, and boy, they were wonderful birds. And they had 2 roosters in that flock. We had 6 mallard ducklings that we were raising to release. I had 2 dogs. Grace, an Irish setter, Sassy, a lab boxer mix. You're going to hear more about them. We had 4 cats, 2 that were in the house, 2 that were in the barn, and our 4-year-old pond. We put that pond in just as we arrived, so it was 4 years old. That 4-year-old pond in 1994 was just emerging, just sort of reaching a critical mass of what it was going to be for a level of life that was just flourishing in that pond, cattails and frogs. And we had a muskrat for a while that decided he couldn't stay that close. But it was a wonderful, wonderful pond. So what I've just shared with you is fairly representative of the roughly 20 years that we lived there, plus or minus, right? Different dogs, different goats. What was unique to that year was Holly. Holly was a starling that I raised from when we found it had fallen out of its nest in front of a Holiday Inn, and that's why we called it Holly. And I raised that starling, and it was my companion for most of that summer. And then it was the one and only year that we raised a hog. In April of that year, it would have been about a 16-pound pink, cute little piglet. By November of that same year, 1994, it was a 350-pound white Yorkshire hog. I grew up within walking distance of a friend's farm. I would take about a 15, maybe it was as much as 20 to 25 minute walk through the woods from my house. This would be about the time I was 7 or 8 till I was into my teenage years, and walk to my friend's family farm. So I spent a whole lot of time on farms, in barns, but this was the first time that it was my responsibility to manage the barnyard, to manage the farm life, that it was mine. And the lesson I learned very early on, I clearly had learned it by 1994, was that you can't practice with this cohort, with this community. You cannot expect to be successful with a command and control approach. You can't tell them what to do, these animals. You can't dictate to them what to do. Instead, I learned to take a climate control approach. The very best outcomes of growth and health and whatever productivity you're looking for from your critters, all the preferred behaviors, all the graceful relationships that you want to have with your animals, that comes from caring, from taking care, from bringing peace and contentment and loving. Right, so there's sort of the climate. Now I want to practice some control. So in that peaceful state, I want to bring them something special, right? They're very satisfied. They're content. Now let's bring them something special. And as I bring them that special thing, I give it a voice. I label it. I speak of why it is a special thing, how awesome it is that you're getting this apple, goats, how awesome it is for you horses that you're getting this carrot, the fatty meat scraps and fish heads that I would throw out to the chickens. All those actions would be accompanied by the voice of what these actions are. I'm going to embarrass myself and give you the voice I would use when I was attracting my goats to a special treat. I would say, "Goaties, come on, goaties." And man, whatever they were doing, they would come running over because they knew they were going to get something special. That voice becomes a promise of even better than what you've got right now. And they want it to be true. So they come up to me and they dance with me. They stay with me. I realized that I'm not looking at animals that are domesticated as much as I realize that together we are domesticating. I'm domesticating them. And you know what? They're domesticating me. What I cared for, what I care for, cares for me. And that was never so clear to me as when I was taking care of the critters that were in my care. I would often take the animals almost every day. I don't remember specifically in 94, but there were lots of years where almost every day I would be taking a group of these animals out into the woods with me. I would be guiding them, leading them out into the woods. And I'm going to talk about those experiences when we come back from the break.
You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius with Carl Nordgren. Welcome back to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Here's your host, Carl Nordgren.
Welcome back. In the first segment, I was talking to you about farmyard animals I have cared for and loved, and I'm just getting ready to lead a cohort of them out into the woods. And so the dogs were almost always with me, and it was a different roster of dogs over those 20 years. The dogs were almost always with me, and they'd lead the way. The goats were almost always coming as well, unless I knew we were going to go for a particularly long walk. I wouldn't bring the goats then, but if it was a regular walk where we would always settle under a tree, in the middle point of that walk, the goats would come nipping, you know, just right at my heels. In that particular year, 94, the hog would come. The little pig would come with us until he was about 200 pounds. I allowed him to come with us, and boy, did he enjoy walking with me in the woods. And in that year as well, I would have Holly, this starling that I told you that I raised. She would be sitting on my shoulder, flying out in the trees, coming back on my shoulder. And finally, one day, as I hoped she would, she just flew away. Well, another lesson that I learned living with critters occurred when I would settle under a tree and I'd pull out a notepad and do some work on some novel or some consulting gig. And the goats, I would watch the goats. When we talk about ruminating, right, we're ruminators. We think about an idea. We consider that idea from lots of different angles. That's us ruminating on it. Of course, there's a whole category of mammals called ruminants. They have two stomachs, and goats are classic ruminants. We often forget how important the first step is. It's always in nature, this first step is for rumination, and that is these goats. They sample quick, fast, furious, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a bit of green, green grass, a bite of new woody growth from that bush. What they're doing at this point is that they're just biting it, ripping it off, and swallowing it. They're not chewing it. They're not digesting it. They're just consuming it, right? They just bring it into their body. And then when that front stomach is full, then with all this wonderful new input, then they come close to me under the tree for a little bit of comfort. They fold their legs underneath them. They bring what they have consumed up, back up again. And then now they really work it. Now they chew it and they chew it and they chew it and they break it down fully. And now when they swallow it, boy, it's going to be fully digested. They're going to get every single benefit they can. So that rapid intake is necessary to really fuel that slow, careful consideration. And that should be the way you think when you're personally ruminating on an idea. Fill up your mind first with a whole lot of new ideas. Then settle under, fold your legs underneath you, sit under a tree, and now ruminate what is going on. What a great form and function, right? Because, of course, these goats in their early ancestors were almost always found in areas where there was sparse vegetation. So just imagine how important it was to have this really very effective strategy for consuming sparse vegetation. When you see it, let's chew it up let's ingest it as fast as we possibly can. Don't take time digesting it. Ingest it as fast as you can. And then really carefully get the full benefit out of all of it. Another thought about this is how wonderful the system is for an animal that is prey. When you and I do for sure, maybe some of you do, when we pig out over Thanksgiving dinner, what do we want to do? We want to just sit on a couch and in our semi-slumber just not worry about a thing. Well, of course, a prey can never do that. A prey has to be continually alert. And so they can't digest a huge amount of food that's going to bring all the blood to their stomach and that's going to slow them down. Instead, this way of eating means that they're always going to be quick, right? They're only just bringing a little bit of food into their stomach, right? Their digestive system is working, but it's not dominating their entire being. They still can move as quick as they need to. So sitting under that tree one day, this was in March. It had rained really, really heavy that year. I think it was a year or two later after the 94 year that I've framed for you, pouring down rain for about a week. We hadn't seen the sun for about a week. Now we finally have a first opening of sunlight. I'm taking my dogs out into the woods for the first time in a while. I sat under a tree that was quite close to the New Hope Creek floodplain. Pretty soon that water flows into Jordan Lake from where we are, and where we are, a whole lot of tributaries, some in Chapel Hill, Orange County, some from all over, right? They've aggregated here, and there was a huge, huge, huge roaring flood coming through the forest after this week of rain. I'm sitting under a tree doing some work, and the dogs take off, as they always did. The dogs always took off and did a nice run, a nice roam. They'd course through the woods, course through the meadows. They'd come back about 5-10 minutes later, check, see if I'm still there, and then they'd go back out again. Well, this time they hadn't come back in a little bit, and I heard barking from a little bit of a distance that it took me just a second to realize the barking was my dogs. Grace was barking, in fact, increasingly frantically. And I thought, well, I better go check this out. I better go see what is the cause. It sounds like a disturbed bark. So I jumped up. I headed in the direction of the bark. I hadn't taken more than a few steps when Grace came running up to me through the meadow. She came running up to me, saw that I was coming. She turned around, and she headed right back again into the woods, and I could see down to the water's edge where this, what was it, probably 50-yard-wide flow of water was just rushing through the trees. Wasn't quite white water, but boy, it was rushing through that roughly, and I couldn't see Sassy, my boxer lab, anywhere. Yes, she's half lab. She hated being in the water. And then I saw her because Grace showed her to me. When Grace got to the shore, she looked out into the water, barked, 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 and I followed her view, and there was Sassy. Sassy was in the middle of this incredible flood between the trees. She was pounding the water with her front legs, and she wasn't making any progress one way or the other. The current wasn't moving her. Her swimming wasn't moving her. She was stuck in that spot with the water rushing around her. And I thought to myself, well, again, this is in the forest. There's probably some deadfalls below, and she's got the back half of her body stuck in the crook of a branch. So I threw off anything I could throw off quickly, my cell phone, my boots, plunged into this freezing, freezing, freezing cold water. I could walk and run and run and walk, and then finally I had to swim a little bit. Grace is right behind me, swimming with me. And when I got to Sassy, and she was exhausted, I realized that a green thorn vine had wrapped around her neck. And the harder she pulled, the tighter it was. So I released it from her neck. I pushed her towards shore. We all made it towards shore. And the minute we got to shore, both Grace and Sassy were as sick as a dog. But Gracie saved Sassy's life. And we'll have more stories for you when you come back.
You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius with Carl Nordgren. Welcome back to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Here's your host, Carl Nordgren.
Welcome back. Thanks for coming back. The first two segments, I shared stories with you about animals, critters that I have loved and lived with and cared for, especially on a six-acre piece of property I had in South Durham County for about 20 years. Now I'm going to switch gears a little bit. We concluded the previous segment talking about how one of my dogs saved the other, how my Irish setter, Grace, saved Sassy from drowning. Let's talk about a bit of dog research. If there's dog lovers, man, on this listening now, you're just going to dig this research so much. I sure do. Picture a rectangular room. In the middle of that room is a barrier. Half the barrier is glass, and half the barrier is opaque. There's a dog at one end of the room, a human at the other end of the room. Both the dog and the human can see through the glass. They can see each other through the glass. Of course, the opaque side, neither can see through. On the dog side of the barrier are two play toys, two chew toys. And when left to their own devices at random, they will roughly go 50-50 as to which one of the two toys they pay attention to that they play with. When, however, the human at one end of the room says to the dog at the far end of the room, when the human says, fetch, folks, 90% of the time, the dog picks the chew toy that is on the glass side. And take just a second to realize what that means. Right? What it means is that these dogs who love us so much and have got such an extraordinarily empathetic relationship with us, they think about how you're thinking. And when they realize that you are asking them to get a chew toy and that you must mean the one on the glass side, because let's face it, you can't see the one on the other side, the dog knows you must mean that one. Wow, I love that. I just love that. Let's talk about our free-range hens for a little bit. I tell you, these birds, these half-wild birds, they got to be so smart because they were allowed to get so smart. They were allowed to roam, right? They ranged all over their section, all around the barn, into the woods, into the fields. They cared for themselves. They took care. They were intelligent enough. I had a lot of folks come and watch these birds over the 20 years, and after a few minutes, it was almost inevitable that they would turn to me and say, I thought chickens were supposed to be stupid. I said, well, we can do a pretty good job of making them stupid if we have to. But no, actually, they can become quite intelligent. And they were very, very smart birds and beautiful birds after three or four generations of a bunch of crossbreeding. Wow, they're half wild looking. The two roosters we had, let's talk about them for a minute. I was a whole lot more impressed with my hens than I was with my roosters. The roosters were quite prepared to, you know, size each other up and to pretend like they're going to get in a fight and occasionally do fight a little bit. But man, if there was a big bird flying overhead that was that either was a hawk or big enough to carry the shape of a hawk, man, the hens would cluck for their chicks and they would put their wings over their chicks and they would protect them, whereas the roosters would disappear. The roosters would go hide. They would just take off. And had no interest at all in saving anybody. I'm going to tell you one last story about the horses. This is a story on perspective. I'll have a clear creative lesson for you on this one, and it's also a fun one. It's a year where I'm boarding horses. I have a 5, maybe 6-year-old nephew come down from Chicago with my sister. And I say to Drew, you know, hey, you want to ride a horse? He says, yeah. So I hop, put him up on a bareback on a horse, put a lead on the halter, and I was leading the horse through the pasture with Drew sitting on top. And I realized that every time I came close at all to a place where a horse had dropped a pile, a flop, horse apples, every time I would walk past one, he would go, ooh, ah, yuck. And if I stepped at all close to it, he would go, oh, God, yuck. So finally, after listening to his disgust for a few minutes, I turned to Drew and I said, Drew, you got to understand something, man. What I see when I see these horse droppings, what I see is chewed up dry grass, nothing more. That's just chewed up dry grass. That's what I see. Without a moment's hesitation, Drew said, well, then there must be something wrong with your eyes. So I hope you think that's funny. I've made a number of people chuckle over the years with that one. But it's also a really good lesson, right? What the perspective that you take on something and who you are shapes the perspective that you take on something. It's going to have everything in the world to do with what you then see. He was disgusted. All he could see was disgust. I saw chewed up grass that I would eventually come out and fork up and put into the compost pile, and it was just simply part of life. So, folks, I hope you enjoyed these stories. I knew I was going to have some that I wasn't going to get to, a story about Holly, a story about the hog, a story about the alpacas that we wound up having for a few years. And so don't be surprised if you don't hear part two of Farmyard Animals I Have Loved. Thank you very much for listening. This is Carl Nordgren.
This has been Exploring Your Creative Genius on 97.9 The Hill. You can listen to other episodes on chapelboro.com.